Good afternoon to all our viewers. Welcome to CDH Conversations. I'm Gift Nkosinathi Xaba. Our discussion today is focused on socioeconomic rights and essentially the rights of South Africans to access fundamental basic services. Our discussion or conversation is going to be premised on the question, when severe state failure fails to trigger any form of accountability, what is the recourse for helpless and underserved citizens whose rights have been fundamentally compromised? And I'm happy to say that I've got with me Zinet, who's going to help me try find some answers to that nuanced and complicated question. Zinet, thank you so much for your time. Always a pleasure engaging with you.
Thank you so much, Gift, and thank you for the opportunity to discuss a topic that is quite apt in South Africa today.
Thank you. For the benefit of those who are not quite familiar with Section 27's work and what you do, could we maybe speak a bit on your work and what Section 27 does?
Sure. So Section 27 is a public interest litigation organization that's based in Braamfontein. We work on two focus areas, which looks at the enhancement for all persons in South Africa to access healthcare and basic education. Section 27 uses a three-pronged methodology in advancing the rights to accessing healthcare or basic education, and that includes research, advocacy, and litigation. And I think with the three methodologies that's used, it allows for a holistic approach to ensuring that communities are equipped to assert their rights. Section 27 started off as the AIDS Law Project, and in 2010 expanded, you know, to include not just to assist people with HIV and AIDS, but people on all areas of healthcare. And we also took the name Section 27, and I'm sure people might be wondering why Section 27. So Section 27 is the right in the Bill of Rights, which speaks to healthcare, water, social welfare, and food. But we do basic education as well, because the two complement each other. And socioeconomic rights is not just accessing food or water. You know, basic education is fundamental to the realization of socioeconomic rights.
Thank you so much, Zinet. Perhaps maybe to unpack this even further, obviously socioeconomic rights have got a link to our past, and obviously the future that we all would like to have in terms of a prosperous life and a dignified life for all. So for a further understanding for our viewers who might not be lawyers, when we speak of socioeconomic rights, fundamentally, I mean, what's the nature and the content of socioeconomic rights?
So socioeconomic rights, I think we need to look at where we were pre-94. And we all know that we've lived in a past where Black people were oppressed and were unable to have the kind of quality access to education, healthcare, water services, and other basic services. And when we came into a democracy, the debate had to be on whether we include the rights to housing, water, sanitation, education, and others, right? And I think that this is why our constitution as it is today is so unique, because the certification judgment that the Constitutional Court grappled with speaks to the justiciability of socioeconomic rights. And this is why we have such a unique constitution. We are 30 years, this year marks 30 years of constitutionalism. And as we reflect over the 30 years as to where we were and how where we are now, it's important to look at how rights and our jurisprudence has developed. But in doing so, we would be able to see the changes and the differences. And by doing that, we can't separate how socioeconomic rights is so linked to the political landscape in which we live. So if we take socioeconomic rights in what Stuart Wilson and Jackie Dugard speak to in one of their earlier articles, where they speak to waves of constitutional cases, right? And they grouped the first wave, which was where the Constitutional Court had to speak to Groot Boom, Subramani, and the TAC case. So why were these three socioeconomic rights cases important? So Subramani and TAC were access to healthcare. Groot Boom was access to adequate housing. But importantly, those cases, especially Groot Boom and TAC, interpret these constitutional rights for us. And it's important because they look at what are the elements of socioeconomic rights. And it's divided into minimum core, progressive realization, and reasonableness. And it's because of this where the court elaborates on what is the state's obligation in realizing the access to healthcare and housing. You know, those cases were really fundamental to the development of socioeconomic rights as years progressed. We get to see that even though those cases were so important, where Grootboom looked at ensuring that people in the Western Cape were provided with houses because of being illegally evicted, but yet we know that Ms. Grootboom died without a house. You then have TAC. TAC case, which looked at providing mothers with antiretroviral treatment. And this provided the healthcare that it needed, and it enhanced the rights to adequate healthcare. We then go on to a second wave of socioeconomic rights cases, right? So we're going to look at the development. And what Stuart Wilson and Jackie Duga do in their article, the second wave and the three cases that they grouped were Mizibuko, Joseph, and Nokotiana. And this is where we see a change in the jurisprudence. So Mizibuko was a access to water matter, and it dealt with a community living in Piri in Soweto, and that community were not given the outcomes that their lawyers put to a court, right? And the court again grappled with progressive realization and minimum core and reasonableness. Yet the Constitutional Court did not grant an order of saying that they could get an increased amount of free water supply, the constitutionality of water meters in Piri. But Joseph's, on the other hand, was a case with electricity. And the lawyers in that case used a different strategy where they linked the right to electricity, but they used PUJA, which is the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, in their litigation strategy, which was very different by just going into a constitutional right because there is no explicit right to electricity. And then you had Nokotiana, which dealt with informal settlement upgrading, and there again, the community lost its case to have their settlement upgraded. But looking at those two waves where you see socioeconomic rights jurisprudence also develop into with basic education cases. And we know that basic education does not have these internal limitations. And also, sorry, I should have added available resources to it, right? But with basic education, it's immediately realizable. You don't have an internal limitation. And this was one of the first cases which actually came to this was the case of Juma Masjid, which the Constitutional Court then asserted that it is an immediately realizable right. So it's with these kind of cases that we see the development, right, over the 30 years. But as we are now, we look at where we at politically. We see a state that is not realizing rights. You see an increase in evictions. You see dilapidated settlements, schools that are not being resourced. Learners do not, to this day, we still have pit latrine toilets in schools. You still have learners who have drowned in pit latrines. Not all learners have access to textbooks, or disabled learners who don't have access to adequate resources within schools. And then we look at, as you drive past various informal settlements and people are living in squalor. And the political dynamic or landscape has definitely impacted the realization of socioeconomic rights. Also, I think we need to take into consideration how our courts are now dealing with it. We're seeing a change in certain respects on the kind of orders we're getting. But even if we get a favorable order, is it implemented? And I think this is where we're at now to see, are the court orders actually tangible and feasible and implementable? And this is the concern with current day socioeconomic rights.
Yeah, again, thanks for those insights. Obviously, the role of the courts has been quite significant in terms of the progresses that we've made in providing our fellow South Africans with a life of dignity and with a life that makes it worth it to be a South African. It seems now there's been some regression in the sense that even with the court orders, right, people are still being failed in that there's no implementation of these orders by the relevant state departments. So it may appear that people have these court orders in their favor, but at the same time, they are merely paper in the sense that it seems that they do not work out for them because they're not being implemented. I mean, recently a case in point is the Tubakgale case against Ekurhuleni Metro, where residents had a court order that goes far back as 2015 that says they must be built houses. And we're almost 11 years later now, and unfortunately, the houses are not there. And quite a number of those residents, unfortunately, have since lost, they've since passed on, and they've lost their lives. So it kind of like brings root boom elements in the sense that, like you said, she died without a house after having fought so much. I mean, we can, maybe for the benefit of the audience, maybe we can touch on Tubakgale a bit and the nuances that case brings and where it is currently. What are the lessons and what's the way forward?
Sure. So I think we need to, before we get into Tubakgale, maybe just take a step back and to tag onto what I previously said, right? If we're looking at what state failure is and the impact of state failure and what kind of remedies we've been achieving or asking courts and seeking and how has this changed, which then links to particularly on Tubakgale, because when we look at how Tubakgale actually being so symptomatic of state failure and how important it became to craft remedies that would actually push the state to actually act. So getting into the Tubakgale case, you know, which is a case that has been litigated by the Socioeconomic Rights Institute, and they've been involved with this community since 2015, or maybe even earlier. But this community, just to give the audience some understanding of the struggle of this community, the residents in the Tubakgale case consisted of 133 residents living in the Winnie Mandela informal settlement. These residents applied for housing in 1998, and it is important because they were granted the houses, but the houses were not allocated. 2015, they go and seek legal representation. SERI institutes the litigation. It eventually gets to court in 2017. So the fight started 1998, right? You get to 2017, you get a favorable court order which says deliver houses. The municipalities, they fight this, they go to the Supreme Court of Appeal and say they're unable to meet the court deadline and they wanted an extension. The Supreme Court of Appeal grants them the extension, they're unable to meet it. They approach the High Court again and they ask for a variation of the order. SERI, interestingly, what they did was they bring a counter application to say we want constitutional damages because now they're seeing this trend of, you know, a dilatory conduct of saying, no, we need an extension. We can't meet this deadline. And when you get to the variation and the counter application, it gets dismissed at the High Court level. And this obviously prompted SERI to approach the Constitutional Court. And I think that this judgment is pivotal into where we're at with socioeconomic rights remedies and how do we use it as litigators in terms of what would be the best outcomes for our clients who are trying to assert and vindicate their socioeconomic rights. So the Tubakgale judgment in the Constitutional Court was handed down in December of 2021. And it was a split decision. There were three judgments. The minority, which was penned by Majid J, provides a very descriptive in understanding the plight of the residents. And very interestingly, Majid J really, you know, looks at what we've always looked at as socioeconomic rights, the squalor that people live in, the impact it has on people's dignity, privacy, equality. You know, because we know communities living in informal settlements also are the poorest, are predominantly Black communities, and people who are living in dire poverty. And when he does that, he then says, but looking at how the municipality has failed them, he's going to grant constitutional damages at 10,000 rand per household. But then we have a majority. And the majority judgment was penned by Jephthah J. And Jephthah J looks at this and says he agrees that the residents have been living in these conditions, but he cannot agree with them being awarded constitutional damages. But he doesn't just leave it there. He takes it a step further, and he says that constitutional damages can never be granted in cases where claimants are needing to vindicate their socioeconomic rights. However, what he does is he says that it's different to civil and political rights. And he draws this distinction between socioeconomic rights and civil and political rights, which says that people who want to assert their civil and political right, which is to protest or the right to vote, would be able to claim constitutional damages, but not for a socioeconomic right, right? So it leaves us all thinking, but how do you draw this distinction? Because it's quite an arbitrary distinction. You can't separate civil and political rights and socioeconomic rights. But before we get into that and our analysis of it, is that the third judgment penned by Midlanga J, who agrees with Jephta J in terms of the facts of the case, but he does something in a 3-4 paragraph judgment, leaves the door open for us as litigators and gave us a bit of hope that we can challenge this judgment, because he says, yes, the residents here are not entitled to it, but this does not mean that a claimant who wants to vindicate their socioeconomic rights cannot do this in the future. It will be open and left for them. And I think that this is where we as Section 27 then latched onto this, because it was an important finding and opinion. But I think that this judgment is also important for people to know that Jephta J's reasoning is not ratio, it's an obiter, right? So it wasn't the majority finding, which is important because we can now still use this and make sure that our clients, if we have clients who want to assert their right to claim constitutional damages, we are able to do that. So sticking with Dubakhale is that this case then returns again for the fourth time now to the High Court in 2022. A judgment was handed down in August of 2023. And in this case, what SERI seeks was an order for contempt, because they had still not received houses. Their residents have not received houses. And in the alternative, they sought constitutional damages. And once again, there's a split decision. So you had two judges who agreed that the municipality was in contempt and who agreed that this is a case now where the claimants would be eligible to obtain and to receive constitutional damages. And the minority of one judge was that there was no contempt. We think that it would have been left there. The court here said houses should have been delivered by December of 2023. We are in 2026. Residents still don't have houses. The municipality approaches the Supreme Court of Appeal, and you're back in court in February of 2026. And Section 27's intervention here was particularly on the constitutional damages of trying to rectify and to get clarity on looking at Jephta J's reasoning that claimants who need to vindicate their socioeconomic rights can do so. And what we have argued is that if we look at all of the jurisprudence as we've discussed today, it provides us with that opportunity, like claimants should be able to. If you have a state that has failed people, then you have no option. And courts have that power to make orders that are just and equitable. And I think it is an important one, because it also tries to take away and clarify that there can never be a distinction between civil and political rights and socioeconomic rights. So this is a challenge of one community. How many more are there? This is one community who had the right to actually access a court, but there are many more who are still in need of having their socioeconomic rights, rights to housing, water, to have that realized, but they don't have the opportunity to access a courtroom.
Yeah, again, very sobering picture and account there. Section 38, as you rightfully pointed out, it empowers the court to make appropriate relief, an order that's just and equitable, and that can actually bring about the right recourse to the citizens whose rights have been compromised. Given that, I mean, with increasing severity, like you had said, it's just South Africans are just battling to access fundamental services. And we hear of protests almost daily. As I referenced in our discussion earlier, that I came across a stat that said there's about 27 protests in South Africa daily, right? In the context of this and these severe failures by the state to provide South Africans with fundamental services, is constitutional damages now, is it now our norm? Is it the way forward? Is it this ultimate recourse, this ultimate direction that we are going into, given all of these severe failures, which have compromised the quality of lives for so many South Africans?
Sure. I think that remedies have changed and the relief sought by litigators on behalf of communities have changed over time. So another important case to link this is the case of Kamape, right, which we as Section 27 have been involved in. And I say this at the back of looking at, because of state failure, the importance for litigators to start including supervisory orders and structural interdicts, which allow state to report to courts. So Kamape, I think, is also, let me just give brief facts to get to where I want to go in terms of remedy, is that Kamape involved the death of a six-year-old little boy in a pit latrine toilet at a school in Limpopo. And these are little learners who are going on a normal day at school and parents let you, you know, drop you off at school thinking you're going to come home and this boy does not return. When Kamape goes to court, Section 27 at the time seek an order for compensation, which they received, and they also claimed constitutional damages. Constitutional damages were not granted at both the High Court and the Supreme Court of Appeal. What the court does there is that it provides a supervisory order, a structural interdict, where it says to the Limpopo Department of Education, you need to eradicate all pit latrine toilets. You need to have an implementation plan, and you need to report to the court and to Section 27 every 6 months. So this was an order that was granted in 2021. Since June of 2022, we have been receiving reports. However, we have to verify those reports to see how much of progress has been made. When we talk about the verification process, because we're still not completed, according to its plan, the Limpopo Department of Education says they're going to complete it by 2030. When we look at the resource intensiveness of civil society that it has taken from us to make sure that all of these pit latrines are going to be eradicated, it's a great order because you can monitor the progress, but it has other implications, right? Because we having to go into schools to verify, and we have over 3,000 schools in Limpopo alone. So it is one way of looking at how remedies have changed, but the importance of supervisory orders in that way. So if we say that supervisory orders are one way where we can look at, you know, would it actually prompt government to actually do its job? But then you have a community like Tubakgale where a supervisory order or structural interdict was not going to work, which takes us to the next step, which is constitutional damages. Constitutional damages has always been debated, and it's been debated because you have those who feel that it is an appropriate remedy, and you have those lawyers who feel that no, it's going to strain state resources. So it's against this backdrop of looking at the change in remedies, political turmoil that we're in, how else do people who need to assert their socioeconomic right, how else could they do it? And that leaves you with no other option but to say that damages might be the only way. However, courts, their jurisprudence has also varied when it came to constitutional damages. So Section 38, as you mentioned and referenced, is correct, but read with Section 72(1)(b) of the Constitution, says that a court has the power to have appropriate relief. And our court's jurisprudence pertaining to appropriate relief is quite profound. So you have the earlier cases of Fose, for example, which says that courts can fashion remedies. They have the power to do that, right? You then have a case like Kate, which awarded constitutional damages. And you then have Tubakgale, which now says what it now says. Clarity is now needed. And it's going to be interesting to see how the Supreme Court of Appeal has actually going to deal with constitutional damages now that it's hearing the case for the second time. And it's now faced to deal and interrogate the viability and feasibility of whether residents living in or wanting a house at Winnie Mandela, are they eligible for an order for constitutional damages? Is this a norm? I don't think so, as I said, because I think it's so debated and it's left to be seen. But I think that with communities having to face consistent failures, you have no option but to say that the state needs to now pay for their failures to realize socioeconomic rights.
Just also for the benefit of the audience, the latest round of Tobakgale, what, 6 or 7 now? The hearing was on the 26th of February at the SCA, and the judgment remains reserved there. And I think once it's been handed down, Zinat and I will have another conversation around that. There's so many nuances and layers around this subject matter. It's clear that the role of the courts is going to remain significant, Zinat, in terms of the struggle for South Africans to access basic needs. It appears to me that it is not sustainable that for South Africans to receive these fundamental services that are so important to their dignity, have to go through the courts all the time before anything is done. Because firstly, I mean, access to courts is expensive. That's the reality. Not every South African is going to have that opportunity. Not every South African is going to, especially underserved South Africans, are going to have that luxury or privilege of having access to legal representation and assistance. It seems to me that it cannot be that receiving fundamental services means that you're going to have to go through the courts and get a court order. So what are the ways within which, you know, South Africans, all of us, from our collective voice as individuals, as responsible South African citizens, as civil society, as a responsible corporate South Africa, what other ways could we use to hold the state accountable?
It's an interesting one because I think there's a lot being done, but we're seeing that it's not really serving a purpose of looking at collective efforts, right? But in order to respond to that, I think we need to look at the roles and responsibilities of every stakeholder that you've mentioned. You have communities, you have civil society, you have the public at large, and then you have business. And what are the responsibilities of everyone? Communities take to the streets. It's a statistic that you've just raised with me today and now saying that there are 27 service delivery protests a day or daily. Do we hear about them? No. Had this happened a few years ago, we used to hear of every service delivery protest, because it meant something and no longer does, because we've now become so desensitized to the realities. You know, it's become a norm to see a pothole on the ground. It's become, so we just shrug it off. So you're not seeing any accountability from all of the other stakeholders that I've mentioned. Civil society works with communities. And we do this through the courts, we do this through awareness, we do this through literacy programs. But it's still, I think, we need to see how do we further that. Then you have business. Business plays an important role. We all know that business and many corporations have CSI programs. They put money and resources into it. But is that enough? You know, you see the economic disparities in society. I mean, driving up today, as I was coming to CDH's offices, had I turned right, I would have been in Alex. I turned left and I'm in opulent Sandton. This is the economic disparities right at our doorstep, but we don't assert ourselves, we don't assist, we don't know how to actually do this, how to continue with the struggle and enhance the struggle, but we do have the resources to do it. And I think we need to interrogate the role of business as much more as just financing social justice projects. And then you have the public at large. And this takes me to our very initial conversation today and discussion today, which says we can't separate civil and political and socioeconomic rights. We're going into local government elections. What do we do? Don't we have a right? Like, our vote matters. How do you vote? And how does that change the landscape of politics? And who do we want to see as running and managing, being the mayor of Johannesburg. We see the crisis that we've been living in. We see communities, and everywhere we look in Johannesburg at the moment, things are deteriorating. But we need to assist and further the voices of communities. And I think that protest, the right to vote, getting people to become more active citizens and that don't feel that a service delivery protest is a disruption of the status quo. We need to get out of that mindset, because it is those protests that, if you enhance the voices and you get that out, is one way of getting government to react. Service delivery protests have been important for communities because it's the only time a community's voice is actually heard. And it's not a disruption to our comfort, because we live in absolute privilege. We work in ivory towers, but we need to understand that this is not the lived reality of the thousands of South Africans. And active citizenry in any way and in any form that requires protest, that requires using the resources that we have to further that, is one of the options and the only option to bridge the gap between those who are most vulnerable and those who are most affluent.
Again, thanks for those insights. And Justice Masineke says in one of his judgments, if the rule of law does not serve the people on the ground, there will be no rule of law, because people are going to find solutions outside that formal rule of law system. As we reflect on the 30 years of our constitutional democracy, we acknowledge, you know, the gains and profound changes that have transformed or that have sought to transform our society. And we treasure the ideals of a dignified and prosperous life for all. But it is apparent that there's so much that still needs to be done. And it is quite apparent further that we are all required as custodians of the future of this nation to realize and embrace our roles. Otherwise, the future is bleak. And quite frankly, the level of disparities and the extent of the suffering of the people on the ground is not sustainable. Thank you so much for your time. I hope that we'll make time again to take this conversation forward, because it is so fundamental on so many levels. Like you had said earlier, that we've become so desensitized because there's just so much struggle and suffering on the ground. Our people live in squalor and are destitute. And this is an indictment to all of us. We cannot continue as though it's business as usual. Thank you so much for your insights, and it's been such a pleasure engaging with you as always. And I thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Gift. I couldn't agree more. And I'm hoping that we can, in the little bits that we do in our own spaces, and if we do this collectively, we can only work and strive towards a better South Africa for all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for your time to our audience. Take good care.
The views and information expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily present those of the firm. All content is provided for general purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. We make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether expressed or implied, that the content on our podcast is accurate, complete, up-to-date, or reflects the current law. We accept no responsibility for any loss or damage, whether direct or consequential, arising from reliance on the information which is presented here.